Speak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Join the car guys, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers, for their advice on things automotive and just about everything else on Car Talk every Sunday at 9 a.m. right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It is Saturday, November 20th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, geek news, and in the second half, we talk about security theater. And that, of course, is the theme song done by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. He made the song available by Creative Commons. And if you want to make a theme song for us and release it under Creative Commons, we'd be happy to play it. Well, once we get through our vetting process, which is very exhaustive and includes, you know, three people listening to it. So, welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I am your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Once again, I am Miles Elam. In the air room with me are Ben Jaffe, freelance media guy, occasional Stanford instructor.
Hello there.
Alex Slias, a security... what is your title?
Application security analyst.
Application security analyst.
Good morning, Miles.
Good morning. And Lindsay Lonnie, systems analyst.
Good morning, Miles.
Well, I got one of you right.
Thank you.
And Miles is just a slacker.
And I'm just a slacker. Well, software engineer, actually. Yeah. I actually haven't been slacking all that much lately.
So. Yeah, that's kind of cool.
So, let's start off with some news, shall we? Ben.
Yeah, all right, cool. Last week, I talked about the LHC and how they were doing
the Large Hadron Collider.
Exactly. The largest particle accelerator made by mankind, and perhaps the most complicated thing we've ever built. More complicated than Photoshop and Windows and skyscrapers. So, last week we covered how they produced temperatures that were greater than 1 trillion degrees, over a million times the temperature of the sun. So what have they done?
It was the temperature of the center of the sun.
Center of the sun, yes. Yeah. Not just the sun as a whole, but... specifically the center, which is the hottest part of the sun. Well, what are they doing this week? And actually, this is not the LHC, but this is CERN, which is the greater research group. And it was some people from Berkeley, actually, who are involved with this. And they actually... So we've been making antimatter for several years now. We've known about it for quite a while, and antimatter being kind of the opposite of matter.
If it's antimatter, does it mean it doesn't matter?
I don't know. I don't know how to respond to that.
I'm thinking it matters.
but if you take antimatter and you take matter and you put them together and they collide or they touch, then they release all of their energy and they annihilate each other in a big flash of light. Or in this case, if you were to just take one atom and an atom of antimatter and an atom of matter and you were to put them together, they make a little microscopic explosion. So we've been making this for a little while. It takes a lot of energy to do, and it's an extremely complicated process. But it turns out now we can actually store it. And if any of you guys out there are Trekkies, I know some people in the room are, they talk in Star Trek about storing antimatter and antimatter containment fields, magnetic fields, using it for their propulsion drive. We've actually done that. Using magnets, we've stored this antimatter.
How much have we stored?
We've stored, they have reported 38 atoms, and that's in like 300-something times running the experiment, they got 38 antimatter atoms. And I don't know, I mean, I think this is pretty impressive because we haven't really been able to store it in the past, and now we're storing it, you know, for...
Right, but we are still a little ways away from the events of the movie Gods and Demons, the Da Vinci Code sequel,
yep.
Where they have a big vial of antimatter that mm-hmm. can totally mm-hmm. blow... the Vatican away and the whole
yeah, yeah.
of that movie. 30 atoms isn't quite enough to do that.
38 atoms. 38.
I'm sorry. Oh, the eighth one. The 38th one is the one that really pushes
you. Yeah, exactly. That puts you over the edge.
It's an exponential thing.
Yeah. So yeah, as I was saying, if you put one atom, one and one together, one matter, one antimatter, it makes a very small explosion. If you look at it on that scale, though, it's a very, very large release
of
energy.
They annihilate each other.
Yeah, they're
annihilated.
It
releases energy. It's not...
Okay,
I guess I think of an explosion as being a combustion reaction or a...
Well, that's somewhat semantic, you know, like if you're a particle physicist or if you're, a physicist, then it probably would matter more. But you can kind of think of it as an explosion, just an immense release of energy.
For the size of an atom.
Immense for the size of an atom. And also immense for any, you get a lot of bang for your buck that way, right? It takes a massive amount of energy to create antimatter. But once you have antimatter, it gives you more energy when it collides with matter than pretty much anything else that we have. Now, how long did they store it? They didn't store it for very long. They only stored it for really just a couple of milliseconds, just a fraction of a second. But here's the thing that a lot of the news articles that I was reading did not report on. It wasn't that they stored it for that long because that's all they could store it for. It's because the only way that they can measure that they actually stored antimatter is to release it and measure the explosion when it collides with the sides of the chamber. So in this interview, there was an interview with NPR and one of the professors that worked on this, and they said, we can't tell you exactly how much right now. We don't quote published numbers, but he said, I usually say it's a number you could measure with a watch. So we may be talking about several seconds. Storing antimatter for several seconds. And of course, this isn't, like storing antimatter in such a way that we would be able to harness it later on and use it for... incidentally, the
measure
other thing
with
is...
a watch. I wonder, like, many of those chronographs go to a hundredth of a second. So the time it takes for you to go beep, beep, that's...
Yeah, sure.
So a tenth of a second would probably be measurable by a watch.
Yeah, but I mean, they stored it for, I think it was a tenth or two-tenths of a second, something like that. But I don't know. It's pretty interesting. The other thing I should mention is, although you get a lot of bang for your buck with antimatter combining with matter, if you were to measure, or if you were to take all the antimatter that they ever produced at CERN, it would pretty much be able to like boil a tea kettle, and that's about it, right? Because we're talking about like producing an atom or two atoms or 38 atoms. We're not talking about producing a gram of the stuff. It would take. Apparently, they were saying it would take longer than the age of the universe to produce a gram of the stuff with this method. So,
with the current method.
With the current method,
otherwise,
exactly.
I'd say, what's the point?
Well, I mean, the point is, we learn a lot about the state of the universe just a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, right? Because we had tons of antimatter, tons of matter, and they all came together and annihilated each other. And somehow, for some reason, we ended up with tons of energy and a little bit of matter, which is us and all of the things that we observe. So kind of trying to solve that mystery of why there is matter in the universe and really the ultimate question, why do we exist? So,
and does it really matter?
That's a good question. That's another good question.
Moving on. Alex?
All right, let's switch gears and go into a little bit more practical applications of technology here. I got a little article. We always hear about iPhones, and we hear about all the phones out there. Well, it seems there's some issues with a Windows phone, where the new Windows 7 phone operating system is modifying mini SD cards. I'm not sure if it's exactly specific phones, but several manufacturers and providers are sending out warnings because the operating system, if you put a mini SD card into one of these phones, modifies the card in a way that it can't be used with any other phone or any other device.
Huh. Which is curious because what card, why would you manufacture a card that could be rendered useless through software? I guess it is through hardware, but I mean, it's essentially through software.
Well, it depends on what it's doing. I mean, it's unclear exactly what it's doing. Some of the claims are that it requires some sort of high, I'm gonna say high quality, but kind of a particular grade of SD card is what Microsoft is saying.
From what I understand, this isn't general memory usage, though. This is something that you would put into the phone and not swap out very often, though. Is that
well? It's a mini SD card. I mean, you store stuff on it.
Right, but is it something that is, you know, a quick release or quick swap jack on the outside that's used for storing photos, or is it something that is more, this is permanent storage for the phone, it just happens to be in that format for easy manufacturing?
No, what the warning is actually to consumers, because consumers are putting their mini SD cards into the phones, and it's rendering their cards unusable.
Right, but, okay. I guess what I wonder is,
it
are consumers
is
doing it because
storage.
They're geeks and they're opening up their phone and doing this, or is it something that's externally...
A lot of the phones that have the mini SD cards or support mini SD cards, it's an external slot on
the
phone.
Right, many phones it is. Is it true for these Windows phones?
It's actually a number of phones, so I'm guessing it's actually going across. And why would they warn consumers otherwise?
I had a Nokia 6230 that you had to switch out the memory card. You had to open up the whole thing, take the battery out, and then swap the card. So,
but is that an SD card?
It was an MMC card.
Yeah, I think this is specifically, is it SD?
It's mini SD card specifically.
Yeah, so those are the ones you pop out.
Yeah, I guess we're talking across purposes, because I'm thinking, are they trying to protect against the geeks who are totally, you know, taking their phone apart to upgrade something that isn't normally upgradable, or is it actually something that is encouraging as a memory upgrade?
I mean, I have a couple Windows phones, and they all have those mini SD cards that you just press on it and it clicks and pops out, and you can use them in multiple devices. But of course, normally, if I've got a Windows phone, I'm going to pop it into another Windows phone, but I don't know.
There's quite a bit of hiss on the mic that you're on.
Interesting.
I only just heard it.
Well, I had turned it down so that we didn't quite hear it, and I'm wondering if you can go try getting another mic.
Yeah, maybe.
Is there one next to you?
There's this weird funky one over here. I could use the funky mic.
Try the funky mic. Let's see if we get some.
Just
better.
Don't get too close to it.
Wait until you do your next story, and then we'll switch over to the funky mic.
I do think, though, even if it was something like where you had to take out the battery to swap out the card, like I have a Nexus 1 and you have to do that, and I did swap out the card because it's really nice to have extra storage. And I think that non-geeks could do that. So I think that would still warrant, you know, warning consumers. If you had to, like, take apart the case of the phone or something, or, like, you know, if you had to re-solder or something, or, you know, that would be, like, major hardcore crazy geek. Sure, it makes sense that they just didn't think about, you know, the fact that they're, you know, basically making these cards unusable otherwise. But
yeah.
Is there a website? So if somebody wants to check, they can... You know, before they switch out their card or something, they can check on the Microsoft site and see if it's applicable to their phone.
I'll post up the link to the article. They actually link to Engadget and a couple other things, so that hopefully there'll be a list of specific concerns. I'm not sure if that's out there yet.
Yeah, well, thank you for that story. Speaking of tinkering with our devices, Lindsay.
Speaking of tinkering, so I've been getting into these robots lately.
Al? What?
I know. Since Al's not here, figured I'd pick up on this. MakerBot makes something called a Thing-O-Matic. And it's a
Thing-O-Matic.
Thing-O-Matic. It's an affordable, they call it affordable, but I guess that's a matter of perspective. It would cost about $1,300 to buy the kit to assemble it yourself. But it's an open source 3D printer. So that's also known as like a rapid prototype machine. And if you know anything about materials engineering, then you would know what this is. Basically, you use a 3D or CAD program, and you feed it into this machine, and it will print out whatever it is that you fed into it out of plastic. So you get the parts for the machine, you build it yourself, and it's small enough to fit on a desktop. So I guess it's probably about 2 to 3 feet wide and maybe 3 to 4 feet tall, maybe smaller than that. I'm not sure the exact dimensions. But you can put a 3D image onto like a USB or thumb drive and plug that into this machine, and it will print just about anything you can create that is 3D as long as it's under the size of 4x4x6. So they have a video on the website of these girls making these salt and pepper shakers that look like little eggs wearing pants. And it's pretty cute. And on this site they also have the little plastic bunnies for Easter and stuff like that. But can you imagine, like, I mean, it gets hot. It's all PVC plastic. And I'm sure it smells terrible, so you'd want to have a well-ventilated space. But it's pretty neat that you could do that as a project, like a family project or something, instead of, you know, the new version of Legos. You actually make your own stuff. You could even probably make Legos.
Just don't try to sell them or else you get sued
by... Copyright, infringement. make your own stuff.
Well, thank you for that story.
Sure.
And I'm going to pot you down so that there's less hiss. And by all means, check out the funky mic while I'm doing this quick little story. Because it's a story I wanted to do a couple weeks ago, but just other news took precedence. This one is, did you know that your choice of web browser can determine what the interest rate on a loan is? Someone found out that when they went to Capital One's online car loan site, that they were, they were trying it out. He tries with one browser and something just wasn't working right. He was using a beta of Firefox, a 4.0 beta. So he figures like, it's a new browser. I'll try something else. But while he was there, he got, it was just under 4%, for the financing. And, or rather about 3.5%. So then he goes in with a different browser. He goes, okay, well, I'll fire up Chrome and see how that works out. And it was a different loan rate, a different percentage. So he starts trying with different browsers. And he finds that depending upon the browser, he gets a different amount. And it isn't him going back to the same site that's causing it to do that. It's he goes back with the previous browser and it still quotes him that same.
Okay, so it does revert back. It's not that it's just changing over time.
Right.
When he goes back with that browser, it goes back to that same rate that browser got.
Exactly.
That's odd.
And so what we're finding is that, or what he was finding was a curious thing where if he goes in with, it goes in with Chrome, the rate was 2.3%. If he goes in with Opera, it's 3.1%. If he goes in with Firefox beta, it's 3.5%.
Oh my gosh, that's a huge difference.
Yes.
Wait, who got the lowest rate?
I believe it was Chrome.
Interesting.
Now, these vendors will choose different criteria to say, like, okay, you live in a particular neighborhood, you have these certain buying habits, you use,
this isn't
try to
something
find
you
statistical
can
analysis. And so they may find, like, well, the people that are more inclined to get a beta browser or more inclined to use this browser, we're noticing this correlation, so then they put that into their metrics.
That is really disturbing. I mean, it's just the browser, they're actually basically, they're making the determination that the browser you use is reflective of your ability to pay a loan back.
Wow, so are you a Chrome person, or are you an Internet Explorer 6 person, or are you a Firefox person? As if you could be a
person. Yeah, there
are no stats
for Internet Explorer here. I believe the person was doing it on a Mac, so he couldn't test with Internet Explorer. Although I would imagine that he should have.
It's not hard to go find a PC.
Well, this is someone just putting up a blog post and they noticed it, and other people going in to confirm it. But
he wrote an article about it, so I mean, he put enough effort he could go find a friend.
Oh, come on, these are bloggers, not journalists.
Uh-huh.
This is we are opinion mongers, not actual journalists.
Interesting.
That's pretty crazy. That's pretty crazy.
I don't know why. That just doesn't seem right to me.
Now, let's see. Lindsay, are you there?
Can you hear me on this one?
Oh,
ooh, that's an even worse one.
Hold on. Let's try this again.
Again?
That's nice.
That
sounds good.
Do I sound like a jazz singer now?
Oh, yeah. And much less hiss. This is so much better.
I don't hear the hiss at all.
Oh, my snake friend is gone.
for those of
is
us,
your last name Voldemort?
Yeah.
Last name? I thought that was like Cher, the full name.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. If Voldemort ever got married.
Stop saying that name on the air. It's freaking me out.
I'm not afraid of the name.
Sorry. Okay, so now we're Harry Potter geeks, apparently.
Aren't we all? So, Ben.
Yeah, so Lindsay just mentioned a story that reminded us all of Al, so I thought I should mention a story that reminds us of Al. I came across the story and I thought, my gosh, why is Al not here this week? Because this is the perfect story for him. Last week he was talking about a robot singer that like sang and dance, and there's like a voice synthesis thing. Now there's a lifelike robot which they've made in Japan, of course, called Geminoid F. And it's taken to the stage. It's an actor or actress, we should say. That's kind of freaky. Like, Al always talks about how they're coming for us next, or Lyle says that sometimes. But last week I said I think they may have skipped us. Like, you know, they just skipped public radio and they went right to the stage and to pop singing and, you know, things like that. I don't know. But the thing I found really interesting about the story, and it's a very short story, but it says actress Briarly Long, who worked alongside the android in a Japanese play titled Sayonara, said she feels it lacks a human presence, making her feel alone on the stage. So I guess acting alongside a robot, co-starring with a robot, is not really very, I don't know, feel alone on stage. Anyway, interesting and kind of scary. I just kind of wonder when the first entirely robot play will be, and whether there will be robots behind the scenes as well, operating the light board and things.
So my question is, to beep or not to beep? That is the question.
Oh dear, oh dear.
I had to put that in there.
Also, while the story itself is scant on details, there is a video, and it is terrifying. It's just completely terrifying. You know, like, you imagine a robot with the eyebrows that only move in one direction, and, you know, the nostrils that flare, and it's all just all looks very artificial. And the mouth, just, it looks like something out of It's a Small World at Disneyland. It's just kind of freaky.
Yeah, that is so freaky.
Okay.
Thank you for that story. Alex.
All right. Well, I'll continue with the topic of phones.
Yeah, you seem to be stuck on that today.
Yeah, well, you know, here we have this world where we have all these great phones, these smartphones, the iPhone, the Android phones, you know, the Windows smartphones. Well, not everybody really likes all the technology and the features and the whiz-bang, wow kind of stuff that are on all these phones. A lot of people like the really simple, basic phone. Give me buttons. Let me press the buttons, make, you know, have some, get somebody on the phone, talk to the person, hang up. That's all the phone should do, period. Well, a Dutch company is actually listening to this sort of market, and they are making what they're calling the world's simplest phone. And it pretty much is just a simple cell phone, very clean, simple design, has the basic buttons to dial a phone call, answer, and hang up. And it doesn't even have some, you know, any sort of fancy interfaces for volume control or any of that. It's like old switches on the side for those technophobes who just don't want all this new technology.
Did they put a rotary?
Yeah, I was going to say.
They should have. That would have been really funny.
And an actual bell.
An actual bell on the top of your cell phone.
Yeah.
And if it's in your pocket, it doesn't ring very well. Cause...
Like the ones on the old alarm clocks with the... The metal bells on the top and the little ringer. That would be perfect.
I had one of those.
Did you?
Yes.
And currently this is being called John's phone.
Who's John?
John's phone?
I don't know.
Somebody
was called John that he probably had as a didn't like technology. But for now, they're just calling it John, as in like John Doe.
John, he hates technology. Yeah, we'll make him a phone. Yeah.
Yeah, it's more of a like a John Doe, a simple, you know, layman's phone.
Okay. and I guess that's the end of that story. Lindsay, what's your next story?
So this is related to my other story. We're still on the missing owl theme. It's another robot similar to the one I talked about before. It's called the RepRap, and it's a free desktop 3D printer capable of printing plastic objects similar to the one before. But this
Did you say a free?
Free desktop 3D printer. Yeah, basically they just give you the plans and stuff online and you can go get the materials yourself and build it. And that's why it's free.
just like my Prius would be free if they gave me the blueprints for it.
Exactly.
Okay.
The other thing about it is they're talking about that it's a recursive, you know, I think they're just wanting to use that word, but recursive printer. It can print its own parts. So part of what the programming does, and it does, the free part is that it's a program and it's open source. And so that's pretty cool. But it can print all of its own parts.
Wait a second. It can print all of its own parts, but only after you have all of its own parts.
Exactly. So
you could print a second one, but that first one...
So how did they make the first printer?
You gotta...
Aha!
That's a great question. Chicken or the egg? I have no idea.
I really am looking forward to, and I'm sure this day is pretty far off, where they can actually make 3D printers which can print every single one of their own parts, including the motors and, you know, things like that. That would be very, very cool. Because what they're probably talking about is just printing all of the plastic parts that make the printer work. And of course, you can find motors wherever, you know, but getting the actual custom plastic pieces that make everything work together, that's the difficulty. And so that's and when the 3D, the self-replication thing happens.
Even better is when they make one like that, that can then assemble a machine assembly machine that can assemble another one of itself. So there'll be
that's
a couple.
Like in Hitchhiker's Guide, when they have the computer that builds a better version of itself.
There you go. Kind of like what you're doing.
Yeah.
There's an interesting side thing of that story. You know, they have a video on their website and everything. It's someone in the UK that put this together or invented it originally. But his thing, he has this idea where his whole concept was that he based it on the symbiosis between plants and animals, like a flower and a bee. And he says that it's like the humans are like the insects, and the machine wants to reproduce itself, but it can't do so without the help of the human, kind of like a bee to a flower. It's like, wow, that's great.
Okay. So, in the effort to make ourselves better, we're going to make the show a little bit better by having our quick little floating break. You are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. And this is Geek Speak. You're welcome to give us a call. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And the wonderful Rick will take your call and patch you in. Ah, yes.
Looks like line one.
Yes.
Yes. Hal, yes.
An old favorite. Hello, Hal.
Good morning. Actually, Rick is wonderful. He really hit it on the nose. I called after you were doing the browser car loan interest rate piece to say that you guys completely missed the most important thing that's going on there, and that is that it's not about the different browser per se. It's what you have done with that browser in the past and the profile they've built of you when you're shopping. So you use Chrome and you shop for shoes, and then you try to find then you do a search, and they'll market a shoe to you, maybe one that you looked at and didn't buy. Then you open Safari and you shop for a certain book, and then you shop for airline flights, or you do a search for cheap airline flights, and there'll be an advertisement for what you just shopped for. So the owners of each of those browsers are marketing your data instantaneously. They've got a profile of you, and what Rick identified is the question is, how can we use browsers to shop and not get profiled and tracked in terms of our buying habits or what we're interested in? Well, so that's the question for you experts.
I'm not sure that the third-party tracking bugs usually would
actually
have cookies.
I'm quite sure it's not the browser companies that would be doing this, though. Simply...
He was just talking about just like tracking bugs, like having the third-party cookies that load in to be able to track your movements.
Right. No, but I mean, it's not the browsers. And I mean, he made a point of that it's not the people developing the browsers that are doing that. It's the browsers support the notion of cookies for tracking, and it's not the purpose and intent for that. Originally was for session management, so that you within a single website or within that you could actually go through and track. And in the browsers enforce that. It's your cookies don't get shared from the browser to from one website to another website. They're generally contained and secured to a single one.
Right.
But what happens is websites have advertisements. My own website uses Google Ads, and what ends up happening is Google is basically present on all these different websites, and so they know where you're at, regardless of whether or not you're actually on a Google site. Of course, then they use that to market and to identify ads and stuff. And it's one of those areas that I think can be abused and concerning. I haven't really decided how I feel about that sort of tracking, though.
But in answer to your question, Hal, is there a way to avoid that? Yes. The newer browsers have what's known as a private browsing mode. And I personally prefer Chrome's method of doing that, because you can choose to be in private browsing, and it's very clear as to...
In certain windows.
Yeah.
Like on a per-window basis, private.
It's fairly clear as to which mode the browser is in. And if you always launch it up in private browsing mode, actually you could always launch a browser in private browsing mode.
I use Chrome. So what do I do to be in private mode?
Whenever you open up a new window, if you press File, New, there's instead File, New Private Window, or New...
New Incognito
Window. New Incognito Window. Or the keyboard shortcut is Command-Shift-N on the Mac, and there's one on Windows, too. So instead of opening up just new windows, open up new Incognito Windows instead, and those will be windows that don't track you.
Right, and any...
So how do I get an Incognito Window? I'm not familiar with that.
That's what you do, is you open up Chrome... And instead of when you go to File and then New Window, instead of choosing that, choose the option just below that, which is New Incognito Window.
Okay, great.
And the browser title bar will turn a different color. Instead of being that slate gray, it ends up being a blue.
Now, I'm curious about the implementation for that. Do they just make it so that all your cookies are blanked from that window so you're starting fresh?
Exactly.
Because really, tracking is just a cookies thing.
Right. That's exactly what it's doing. It allows cookies to be used so that when you're logging in, you can stay on a site.
You need function.
But when you close the browser, when you close that window, there's no history with regard to, there's no images that have been downloaded to cache. There's no JavaScript that's been downloaded to cache. There's no cookies.
Yeah, I mean, an alternative way it sounds like would be to just set your browser so that it deletes cookies every time you close the browser.
Right, and like I said, there are many browsers. Firefox and Safari both support a private browsing mode. Although that's you can turn it on private browsing mode and just leave it there, and then every window you ever use is going to be like that.
Yeah, of course, the one odd, I'd say inconvenient thing is there is a nice convenience about having these sort of session cookies where you go back to a site and you don't have to keep... logging in for every site you have and all that sort of thing.
Right.
Now,
the shortcut is Control-Shift-N.
Control-Shift-N on Windows, Command-Shift-N on the Mac.
Yeah.
Two other things. Google, for example, and actually I believe most of the networks do this, have a preferences setting, and you can just opt out to, if you want ads to not be based on any of your interests or the demographics that they collect about you, you can just opt out of that, and then Google disables that part of the cookie. They'll still know if you log in, but they won't collect information and target ads to you based on your demographics, which is what you were talking about. And then the other thing is with regard to the original article of it targeting on a per browser basis and giving you different interest rates, just to be clear, that's a completely separate thing, where they're looking at your browser user agent and then feeding you a different rate or something. That has nothing to do with cookies and nothing to do with ad tracking.
Right. Chances are, actually, this person who has it, he may have two different browsers that have a profile history that they can do that calculation on. But I'm a little skeptical that it's the tracking cookies that you were describing, where they're tracking the information and getting a profile for each browser, because I would believe that 99 times out of 100, the person that has that many browsers on their system is a web developer, and they're not using many of those browsers for day-to-day use. They're using that browser to look at that specific website that they are developing.
Mm-hmm.
And so every browser would have that on their system, and many browsers would not have basically any browsing history besides that.
And
what you guys are saying, it's completely on my computer. It's not somewhere where Google is tracking me so they can sell my information or sell ads based on my behavior to people who might pay them for the opportunity to market to me again.
On the contrary, that is on there. We're talking about two different things. They're apples and oranges. So this guy that did this profile, it sounds very much like the browser is determining whether or not the insurance rates are higher or lower. Or I'm sorry, the
interest rates.
Interest rates.
The browser version, not the information about the user that has been using that browser. Yeah,
so that's issue one, and then issue two.
But in answer to your question, yes. Google and their marketplace, Amazon, the others.
Different ad networks.
Yeah, do keep information and look at your buying habits and do try to get profile information on
it. But it's also important to note that for the most part, it's not necessarily you they're identifying. They're identifying a number that is stuck in your browser. So it seems personal to you because the number has been keyed to your browser until you clear your cookies again. And so as you're browsing, that number keeps telling them that, hey, this is the user number 123456. And so that adds, as you keep using the user 123456, are being tailored to your own browsing.
Yeah, but if you walked into a library and logged into the computer there and went to the same website, it would be different.
Yes. It would be very different, and they wouldn't know who you are.
Yeah.
Okay.
Does that answer your question, Sal?
Well, I There was a couple of interviews with a woman from the Wall Street Journal who did a book recently about the tracking in the way that I thought it was being done, which I guess you guys are saying it's not. So for me, it's still an open question. But as far as the way I use my browser, you were helpful. Thank you.
I wouldn't just quickly discount what the other book would say necessarily, because it is very complicated.
Yeah.
There is a lot of information sharing. There's a lot of correlation that occurs in the back end. In a lot of ways, they do tie it to your name in certain databases. But that is largely the nature of the internet. As we use it, we are putting information out there about who we are and what we do.
Right,
and that's
exactly.
Being collected. And there is a big concern, in terms of what happens as we start to hit a larger and larger amount of this information, the point where you can very quickly identify a person, who they are, what they do, how they think, and everything about them. And what happens if that ability just goes out into anybody's hands?
Yeah, and something I heard recently is when you do a like on Facebook, then not only you, but all of your friends get profiled accordingly. There's just a massive kind of harvesting of
data. If you click on an ad, yes. If you click on an ad or you become a fan of some app or something like that.
To a limited extent.
Yeah, that is the case, yeah.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's definitely very important to not necessarily make the jump from ad networks exist and they track us based on basic demographics and user IDs to everyone is tracking everything. That's a very easy jump to make, and it's very easy to get scared about those kinds of things, but it's not necessarily one or the other. It's kind of a false dichotomy. It's more of a scale, or not even a one-dimensional scale. It's just kind of a very complex issue.
Also, something that I wonder about with regard to tailoring searches, like, for example, I'm sure anyone who's been on the internet and has gone to Amazon has seen if people who looked at this were also interested in this other product. Mm-hmm. And there are some times where it goes way off base, but there are many times you look at it and you're like, yeah, that is kind of something that would be interested in. I don't know if I have money for it right now, but Netflix being another case where, oh, I looked at these movies and people like you like these movies, and you look in the movie recommendations for you are very impressive.
Yeah.
Not
Pandora,
always on the mark, but very impressive. Yes,
yeah,
Pandora as well. And the implication to that is fairly disturbing to many people, which is you are not a unique snowflake. you are very much like many other people. And that's the way that they are. It's not quite that bad. It's just that when we think of ourselves as being individuals, when we have individual tastes, we are not as distinct as we like to think we are. We are actually fit, and we do actually fit many different measurable patterns.
Yeah.
Within limited context, I think that's very true.
Yeah.
But we're very
yeah.
complex overall. But
certainly.
Within movie
certainly.
Tastes, we tend to like a lot of common things. People who like certain things tend to like certain other things
right.
because of the relation that those things have to each other.
Right, but the buying habits is one where I think it does transcend a few lines that we used to think of being separate.
Yeah, I think I can see
where you
see
start
that.
Seeing one product, and you see another product that is very different interest level, but the people who were interested in this also tend to be, this political
right.
outlook and want to get this type of calendar.
Although...
People who use this kind of browser tend to, no, I'm just kidding.
tend to not pay their debts back.
But I mean, at the same time, I think that's really fascinating as far as being a study of how humans think and how we work, because it's how we tend to associate things that we're seeing in that sort of the computing that's determining that and actually end up being accurate, that these fairly unrelated things actually are related. That relation actually exists in our own brains.
Right, which actually comes into a nice segue to the topic I wanted to talk about with, a nice security guy in here, which is the TSA. It's been in the news a lot talking about, is it okay for the government to have the backscatter, the millimeter wave machines, and or the pat-downs that some have considered intrusive.
And this is relatively recently that they've started.
And this is very recently that they've done
so. More aggressively, yeah.
And let's just get the tech out of the way. The scanners that are millimeter wave versus backscatter, there are two different technologies. The backscatter are X-rays just at a low level, so they're not penetrating as much. At the same time, there have been concerns from from some scientists at UCSF, among other places, talking about we haven't done any tests because we've looked at the radiation levels, but it's all being absorbed by the skin. So is that going to be a skin cancer risk?
My dentist still puts a lead blanket over me when I get x-rays done.
That is true, but at the same time, someone who works with it is going to be someone who's just getting that one look for the dental work is not the same as the person that is administering.
Well,
the,
what does your dentist do when they go patients. And do it? They step outside of the room or stand behind a very big shield.
Right, because they would be exposed to over time to many different patients, to every patient they ever did. So it is important for them to limit their dose compared to the individual person. But we haven't had these tests for what happens with a cancer survivor, someone who really shouldn't be exposed to any radiation at all because they are at a very high risk rate. So, you know, it's not really clearly labeled as whether they're backscatter or millimeter wave. But anyway, millimeter wave is equivalent to a microwave only at a much lower intensity level. So we're talking about higher than perhaps a cell phone, but lower than much lower than a microwave, but the same similar frequencies. And they're not, it's non-ionizing radiation. In other words, you don't have enough energy in that picture, that imaging, to knock electrons off of their orbit. In other words, you're not going to be manipulating DNA and then causing mutations that way, and then by association causing cancer. So we want to split that off right now before we even get into the conversation about the security measures to talk about there's some that could be a problem, but we don't have any evidence for it. And we have another class of scanner that, as far as we know from the technology, there's no path, there's no vector for disease. It just becomes a question. But then we have the question of we're having photos that are not too far away from showing nudity.
Yeah, because they go through the clothing, but they don't go through the skin because of the nature of the scanners.
Right. Now, is that good security?
Good security to be able to show... The question is whether or not it's effective.
Right.
I mean, it shouldn't be whether or not I can imagine you know, that this makes me more secure or it gives me the feeling that this is more secure. The question really is and should be, does this actually result in fewer attacks, much lower risk of actually having some sort of incident?
So, Alex, you're coming at this from the point of view of and using verbiage that I would expect from a computer security professional, which is...
Stop feeling. At least stop making the decision based on emotion and feeling. It really needs to be based on real either statistics or real evidence that this sort of measure actually helps mitigate the real risk.
So how would you know that there isn't evidence for this?
Well, I mean...
Because we don't have access to the evidence, how do you know that there is no...
Well, there's different organizations that have actually gone and done studies. I mean, Israeli forces have actually come out and Israeli security forces have actually stated that these backscatter devices do not actually impact reduce the risk of bombings.
Okay, so we're looking at specific examples.
Yeah, research has been done by various organizations. I mean, actually a really good thing, have you been to Bruce Schneier's blog lately?
Yeah, Bruce Schneier being a luminary in the security world.
Yeah, he originally was really heavy on cryptography, and he's since expanded out of that, and he even looks at security as more, you need to incorporate the social aspects of it, how we feel about things, and add that as part of the overall equation. And
you mean like, do we feel secure or do we feel insecure?
Yeah, well, addressing that as an aspect, but it's separate than the reality of security, but not discarding it entirely. Mm-hmm. And he recently just had a blog post that was just a big summary of different articles, a lot of references. If you go to Schneier.com, it has a ton of information about just different, all the different arguments and problems with these backscatter X-ray devices.
Now, everything that I'm about to say is not an endorsement that you should do it. I'm all for people being safe when they're traveling. But at the same time, when going to the security lines, I was recently went to the rally in D.C. A month back or so, and in there, one of the things I noticed was because of security measures being heightened, you had just really long lines, no security lines. Now, before anyone even gets onto the plane, why wouldn't someone have a bomb, walk up to those security lines that are going out the door, and then you detonate it? You've killed 100 people, and you shut down the airport.
Right.
And for that matter, if you're going for number of people, then why not just go to a shopping mall on, you know, Black Friday? You know, things like that. So there's that. There's the
you're
aspect
gonna
of...
You're going to get a GPS on your car now.
I'm going to get a GPS on my car now. And so, I mean, these are the things we talk about in the difference between security theater versus actual security. Or effective security, I guess, is the better
way. Well, the security theater is about, you know, addressing people's fears. And, you know, it's about making people think that, you know, one, they're at higher risk, so they have a higher fear, and then that there's this thing that's going to make you feel better. And people think that, you know, that addressing that emotional response is the reality of security, but it's not necessarily. And sometimes things that are actually quite secure are don't feel safe. I mean, you go on a roller coaster, it's in some theme park, it's thrilling because it feels scary and it feels dangerous. But in reality, those things are super safe. You know, it's a parallel you can kind of draw in terms of separating the feeling from the reality.
Yeah. Well, they are reasonably safe, but yeah. They're safe enough where the comparison between getting a roller coaster and then getting on the freeway are...
Yet we feel comfortable driving because we're behind the wheel.
Right.
And yet you're probably at much higher risk in situations where you're not in control. So that's really what security theater is that playing with the emotional understanding of a feeling of safety versus the actual reality of safety.
Yeah. Or like the original Windows firewall, the illusion of safety without the action, the actuality of safety.
So what is,
I had to bring this back to computer somehow.
Just my layman's question about that is, what are these things going to show that isn't already found by current technology for security at the security checkpoint? Is it just that the current technology is faulty, or we're having people carrying things that can't be seen by that because it's not metal, or...
Right. Well, there is that aspect of, for example, I was reading an article about sapphire knives, little blades that are made out of sapphire, you know, just one step below diamond in terms of hardness. Very expensive, but at the same time, absolutely no metal in them, and they would not be caught by a metal detector. But could they be caught by this millimeter wave scanner? Maybe, yeah. It's okay. Fairly dense, so it would show up.
All right.
At the same time, like, if it were put into a bag, would it be noticed?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, a lot of the things here is that there's an escalation that is occurring that, and we see this in computer security as well. We come up with a measure to block some known methods of attack, and the people who are trying to attack come up with a way around it.
Right.
So far we're not seeing that there's any way to block things because we want to be able to, for example, travel. Well, you can't be able to travel if, you know, the only way to truly make travel secure is to stop the ability to travel.
Right. Or do strip searches with an orifice search as well.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that would stop everybody from traveling if they had to go through that.
But exactly. But I mean, that's something that would get past a millimeter search right now, is someone having a charger and putting it up an orifice and being able to walk through. No problem.
There's actually several organizations that are calling for pulling back a lot of the measures that we're putting into place because they're not seeing a substantial increase in actual security. There's a huge cost associated to it, and it's building a culture of fear. And yet you look at the past, we felt a lot more comfortable traveling in the 80s and the 90s. And, you know, we could say, well, we now have, you know, we're more secure now, but...
we aren't, right?
Yeah, the thing is, but we don't feel more secure. Everybody thinks that we're at high risk. Yeah. And but back then there was far more bombings. I mean, there was far more incidents worldwide.
Yeah, the Pan Am bombing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading an article where there was an overlap of, like, in a 4-year period, there was all these incidents that occurred. Just every few months, it was some sort of major occurrence. So, do we feel safe or not?
Yeah, this is an ongoing discussion. This is something that I think everyone should just take some time and think about it and discuss it with friends. And, you know, let's try to come to a it's some consensus about it. It's a as a culture, because it's something we do need to deal with, or at least many of us who ever do any traveling, especially now that Thanksgiving is coming up and people are going to be traveling all around the world for that. Ben, very quickly, USB.
USB device. Yeah, I don't have a USB device. That's Al's turf. But I do have something USB related, which is that evangelical Christians in Brazil have banned the use of USB connections. Talk about banning something ubiquitous. Because the mark of the technology, the little icon, looks like a trident and looks like the mark of Satan worshippers. So therefore, no USB devices. Sorry, Brazilians.
Okay. Now, that would be security theater.
Yeah, yeah. That.
And in other news, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. And GeekSpeak is a registered trademark of David Lawrence of Online Tonight, and we thank the Puppet Master for its use. Thank you, Ben, Alex, Lindsay.
Thank you, Miles.
Thank you, Miles.